The First Thing is First Thing with Mike Parsons and Renee Vitale on 760 WJR and on the WJR app, where Michigan comes to talk.
Well, they found him after 43 hours, 20 different SWAT teams. Vance Boatler, the man accused of shooting and killing Minnesota State House Democrat leader Melissa Hortman and her husband and shooting State Senator Josh Hoffman and his wife Yvette, was found in a rural county in Minnesota, about a county over from where the shootings happened. And he crawled out to law enforcement, and that in itself had to have been a pretty pitiful sight. And I would imagine if I were one of these law enforcement officers, I would feel a secret sense of satisfaction watching this guy crawl out to law enforcement.
Oh, absolutely. And they're calling this capture as the largest manhunt in the state's history. What a crazy story this is in general, Mike.
It really is. There's so many twists and turns. Now, number one, this Boatler guy, he gained access to the homes of these two Minnesota lawmakers by posing as a police officer and wearing a latex mask or something. Yeah. Have you seen that screenshot of the security footage of him? I don't know which one of the lawmakers' doors he was at, but
very bizarre.
It's very creepy. And this happened dead of night, and you know, for police, and I would be curious to hear what his story was when he was knocking on the door of leader Hortman or Senator Hoffman to get them to open up. I believe that this happened between 2 a.m. and 3:30 a.m. local time in Minnesota on Saturday morning.
Yeah, and he had been driving what appeared to be a police car, also a strange twist. And then they discovered a manifesto in his abandoned vehicle listing multiple lawmakers and officials as potential targets, including those outspoken on abortion rights. So this could have become, a far crazier situation, because seemed like the man was on a mission for sure.
Well, and on top of that, they found a whole bunch of, now, I don't know if it was flyers for a No Kings protest or just a bunch of pieces of paper that had No Kings scrawled on it. But he also had, and I don't know if this was in the same vehicle or there was a second vehicle. Those details are a little hazy to me, but they found three AK-47s. So was he planning on doing something even more catastrophic at one of these No King rallies, right, or protests?
Right. And Governor Tim Walz condemning the shootings as a politically motivated assassination, and ordering the flags to fly at half staff. How horrible for these families as well.
Yeah, well, speaking of Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, the story takes another twist, because Vance Boatler and Senator Hoffman, they served on a state board together. This, according to ABC News. Back in 2016, Boatler was appointed to the Minnesota Governor's Workforce Development Board. I guess they're tasked with analyzing and recommending policies to the governor and legislature on workforce and resources. Now, Boatler's appointment as a private sector representative back then from Governor Mark Dayton came due to the, quote, special trust and confidence he earned in his, quote, integrity, judgment, and ability, according to official notice of appointment that Boatler had. And then he was reappointed in 2019 by Tim Walz.
Wow.
So, and here's the thing. I don't know exactly what this board does. I mean, there is a vague description of it just now, or how much contact these two had, but it seemed like at least they were linked in this way. So we don't know if they actually knew each other. We don't know why he decided to start with Melissa Hortman or Josh Hoffman. There were a number of other high profile Democrats on that hit list. And by the way, Senator Hoffman, his wife, they had surgery. They're expected to live. Boatler is facing second-degree murder and attempted second-degree murder charges. But, yeah, a lot of twists and turns here. It'll be interesting to hear what his motive was, because this hit list, was, as far as I know, so far appeared to be all Democrats. But it seemed like he had some Democrat leanings himself. So is he a former Democrat that got radicalized? You know, just a lot of questions still unanswered. And in that sense, it's good that they took him alive, even though they would have been justified taking him, taking him out.
Yeah. Just can you imagine the sense of relief for all these people that this man has been captured?
I mean, there was a shelter in place order. Yeah. I was thinking this might take a while because this Boatler guy, he was head of some kind of like security firm. So he might
have. Yeah, that was hazy too, those details.
Yeah. But that made you think, okay, maybe he knows how law enforcement thinks, and this might be a lengthier manhunt than it has been. Meanwhile, on Saturday, I feel like this military parade kind of came and went without a whole lot of buzz and a whole lot of juice.
Well, as you and I were talking before we went on the air, Mike, I think that it was the timing. Saturday at like, 6:30? That in the summer, and people got stuff going on. They're not necessarily glued to must-see TV of a parade.
Right. And I was out and about on Saturday. And so I DVR'd it just because I was curious how it looked. And I got to be honest, if I didn't DVR it and I didn't see the report on it on the evening news at 11, it would have come and gone and I would have forgot it even happened.
And I think the bigger story were these No Kings protests all over the country.
Yeah, I mean, 1,800 nationwide. I don't know the number of people participating was in the millions. There were 70 planned here in Metro or Michigan overall. And it seemed like they mostly stayed peaceful. There was a brief skirmish at Clark Park between some bikers and some protesters, but police arrived and defrayed the situation. Reports of gunfire in Salt Lake City, one person wounded, no life-threatening injuries. And there was some kind of incident in Virginia, I believe.
Yeah, in Culpeper, a man drove his SUV through a crowd of demonstrators as the protest was ending. Fortunately, though, no injuries. And then in Texas, the state capitol was evacuated due to a credible threat against legislators. Right.
Wow, I didn't know that. But yeah, overall, though, it seemed like I think we were all kind of on edge because, even if 1,798 of these remained peaceful, it only took one or two to get out of hand.
Sure.
And it seemed like it didn't. It seemed like they stayed mostly peaceful. But yeah, going back to Trump's military parade, it also seemed like the support of it was tepid at best, from everything from Republicans to, military leaders thinking that it was a bit frivolous. It was a bit self-aggrandizing. It projected an authoritarian image.
Visually, it wasn't appealing to people on both sides of the aisle. And the price tag on it was not appealing to many on both sides of the aisle. $40 million, I think, was the cost. I heard
anywhere from 25 to 50, so 40 would be right in that. But but it seemed like not a lot of people were excited for it to begin with, and it just kind of came and went without incident. So I don't know. I don't know if they're planning on doing another one next year. But meanwhile, overseas, it does not seem like this confrontation, I don't know if I'm going to call it a war yet. It seems like it's heading that way, but this confrontation between Israel and Iran isn't going to be ending anytime soon.
No, more explosions hit the Iranian capital over the weekend as the Iran-Israel conflict intensified. Following Israeli strikes on energy and defense infrastructure, Israel's military said, "We won't stop striking for one moment." At least 13 are confirmed dead in Israel in the hostilities. Visiting the scene of a strike that killed four people, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said, "Think what would happen if Iran had atomic weapons." A stated goal of the Israeli operation is to stop Iran developing a nuclear bomb. Some Tehran residents have been escaping north to safer rural areas, while others have been stockpiling essentials. And scores are reported killed, but no official figure has been given. Israel's operation against Iran, expected to take weeks, not days, and is moving forward with implicit U.S. approval. President Trump said his country had nothing to do with the Israeli attacks, but warned Iran not to hit U.S. targets, stating that full force of the American military would respond if provoked. And then President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin spoke for nearly an hour on Saturday in a phone call that, you know, largely centered on escalating tensions in the Middle East and this ongoing war in Ukraine. In a statement released by the White House, Trump said Putin called him on Saturday to wish me a happy birthday, but more importantly, to talk about Iran, a country that he knows very well. Trump described the conversation as good, but he acknowledged that it would not lead to immediate peace, particularly regarding Ukraine's recent drone strikes on Russian airfields. And Putin told Trump that Moscow would have to respond to the attacks, although those details on what that entails remain unclear. And then the Kremlin also stated that the leaders discussed prisoner exchanges between Russia and Ukraine, as well as broader diplomatic efforts to resolve conflicts in the region. That call, you know, comes amid all these growing concerns over Russia's deepening ties with Iran. So,
yeah,
it doesn't sound like it was ultra productive.
At least it was thoughtful of him to wish him a happy birthday.
That's
first
right.
Thing. Mike Parsons, Renee Vitale, WJR. And we're heading into JR Morning with Chris, Lloyd, and Jamie. And among all the No Kings protests this weekend, the military parade, it seems like the biggest story far and away was this manhunt in Minnesota for suspect Vince Boatler, who shot Minnesota State House Democrat leader Melissa Hortman, shooting and killing her and her husband in their home, shooting Senator John Hoffman and his wife Yvette. And outside of the shooting itself, I don't know what's more of a surprising twist in this, that he posed as a law enforcement officer wearing a latex mask, or that he actually served on a board with Senator Hoffman.
The whole thing is so terribly scary, and it just feels like there's an escalation here in political violence in this country.
Yeah, 100%. And I thought this manhunt could have gone on a lot longer, especially with his what seemed to be his background as head of some kind of security service. But, you know, they found a manifesto in his car.
That was really scary.
Yeah, and I don't know if they found a second vehicle or this was all found in the same vehicle, but there was either a flyer for a No Kings protest or just No Kings written over and over on a piece of paper and a number of AK-47s. So it sounded like he was looking to expand this on an individual basis. And I don't know if a bigger tragedy at a large event like a No Kings protest was thwarted here.
Yeah, I just, you know, I guess we'll find out as they get answers from this guy. But he sounds like a crazy person. He sounds like somebody who is deranged, somebody who is completely untouched from reality. And so I just, you know, I know we're all quick to like point blame and he's a this or they're a this and they voted for this person. And I think crazy is accessible across the entire political spectrum. I mean, you know, to me, we're going to figure out more about this guy in the coming days as more information becomes available. But, yeah, I mean, just a scary situation. I mean, you go to a lawmaker's house and impersonate a police officer. You got problems.
Right. And it's chilling because I think what these lawmakers did is what any of us would do. You hear a knock on your door in the middle of the night. They say this is the police. I don't know what kind of cover story that this Boatler guy gave the two lawmakers. But you wake up in the middle of the night, the police, someone posing as the police knock on your door. You look outside. They look legitimate. You're going to open the door because, oh, my God, what's happening? And I think that, you know, that I can't say what makes this story the most chilling, but that definitely is a very, very chilling part of this story. So glad they caught him. The biggest manhunt in Minnesota state history. And I think it took, 20 different SWAT teams. And they found him in a field in rural Minnesota, and he crawled out to law enforcement, which I'm sure had to be somewhat satisfying, especially the fact that he was impersonating law enforcement to gain entry.
I read that he had property in that area nearby.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it's a county over from where it happened. So it sounds like it'd be like one of our, it'd be akin to one of our suburban counties.
Yeah.
So that makes sense. But yeah, they found him alive, and I'm sure that we're going to find out more details about this. And there were a number of high profile Democrats on his hit list. I'm sure there were more. But
imagine
yeah,
you I were mean, on that hit list. Scary.
Right.
I know.
Right.
And I mean, being a lawmaker nowadays has to be, this is probably a scary and unfortunate reality of your day-to-day life. I think if you were to ask any elected official, you know, when was the last time there was a threat against you that you're aware of, yeah, we probably would be surprised at how recent and how frequently it has happened. JR Morning coming up. The deadly conflict between Israel and Iran has entered its fourth day, with both sides firing waves of missiles overnight. Iran's early Monday strikes have hit an Israeli oil refinery and damaged part of the power grid. Casualties are mounting on both sides as Iran and Israel widen their attacks. The last count was 230 overall late last night. That may have changed. Tehran residents are attempting to flee the capital in search of safety, while explosions were seen in Israel overnight. Residential buildings have been hit. Two U.S. officials told CNN that President Trump rejected an Israeli plan to kill Iran's supreme leader. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu denied reports of such a plan. Israel's operation against Iran is expected to take weeks, not days, according to Netanyahu. And President Trump is pressuring Iran to make a deal on its nuclear activity, warning of even more brutal attacks by Israel. Iran said they're not going to make a deal while they're under attack. Trump claimed that Israel has the best military equipment and knows how to use it, hinting at future attacks. Secretary of State Marco Rubio denies U.S. involvement in the strikes and urged Iran not to attack U.S. positions. Renee, you broke this news to me. I guess that Vladimir Putin called Donald Trump up over the weekend to wish him a happy birthday. And
hey,
they
man,
talked about
happy birthday. Anything fun planned?
Yeah. Eh. Anything new?
Drill, baby, drill.
But Donald Trump said he would be open to Vladimir Putin and Russia playing a peacekeeper role here, which is very interesting because obviously, depending on the week, the United States and Russia are at odds over Ukraine, but they're thinking of maybe working together on some kind of peace between Iran and Israel. And it just sounds very, very messy.
Yeah, a lot going on both sides. But hey, yeah, he took time out of his busy schedule to wish him a happy birthday. So there's that's right. That.
And he didn't just post it on his Facebook wall.
Right.
He picked up the phone. So good news. The man accused of shooting two Minnesota lawmakers, killing one of them, has been arrested, but this story has a lot of twists and turns.
Yeah, and that man's name is Vance Bolter. A local police chief described the chase to capture Bolter as the largest manhunt in the state's history. Bolter's charged with two counts of murder in the second degree and two counts of attempted murder in the second degree. State Representative Melissa Hortman, the top Democrat in the Minnesota House, and her husband were shot dead on Saturday. The gunman shot Democratic State Senator John Hoffman and his wife, who survived the attack. Bolter was a political appointee of Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. Police say that a man dressed like a police officer came out of Hortman's home and shot at police before escaping. And he also had on this strange latex like Halloween mask, and he had been driving what appeared to be a police car. Bolter's employment status unclear. According to his company's website, he did work in security services. Investigators discovered a manifesto in Bolter's abandoned vehicle listing multiple lawmakers and officials as potential targets, including those outspoken on abortion rights. Governor Tim Walz condemned the shootings as a politically motivated assassination and ordered flags to fly at half staff in Hortman's honor.
President Donald Trump directed federal immigration officials to prioritize deportations from Democratic-run cities, a move that comes after large protests erupted in Los Angeles and other major cities against the Trump administration immigration policies. No kings. Trump, in a long, rambling social media post, called on U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials to, quote, do all in their power to achieve the very important goal of delivering the single largest mass deportation in history. He went on to say, in order to achieve this, we must expand efforts to detain and deport illegal aliens in America's largest cities. Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, where millions upon millions of illegal aliens reside. These and other such cities are the core of the Democratic power system. Nolan Finley, friend of the station, Detroit News editorial page editor at the Detroit News, reported this weekend that the No Labels Party is weighing an endorsement of Mayor Mike Duggan as independent for governor. Former Congressman Dave Trott checks in with Nolan. I'm sorry, he checks in with the mayor on All Talk.
So I travel around the country, and I tell people I'm from Detroit, and inevitably, people say, I got to get to Detroit. I'm hearing great things about Detroit. I want to see a Tiger game. I want to go to the Rocket Classic. The NFL draft was legendary. And so we have with us this morning the man that had such a big role in making all this happen, Mayor Mike Duggan. Mayor, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks, David. And it is definitely a good year to go to a Tigers game.
That's for sure. And we're going to have a big weekend with the Tigers, with the Cincinnati Reds in town this weekend. But
I'll be down there. It is an amazing atmosphere at the ballpark these days.
That's for certain. So you've been mayor for 12 years. You've accomplished so much. You've improved emergency services and response times, and had a very successful demolition program. Improved lighting. Increased the number of parks tenfold. Got the lowest unemployment in 25 years. One of your most significant accomplishments, Mayor, is we've had the first net population increase, I think, since 1957. How did you make this all happen? I mean, I know it was a team, but really incredible accomplishments over the past 12 years.
Well, the Census Bureau just put out a map of the 100 cities in America that grew the most in population in 2024, and of course, lots of dots clustered in Florida and Texas and Arizona, but there's a big dot in southeastern Michigan. I never thought I'd see the day that Detroit was one of the top 100 fastest growing cities in America, but I'm getting that chart framed for the office. A lot of people came together to make that happen, but it does give you a sense of how far we've come.
And what do you think the impetus was? I mean, to have that net population increase. I mean, the city looks great, and there's so many businesses relocating to the city. Is that the driver, do you think?
Oh, I mean, we've had huge numbers of young people moving in, and you can see there's apartments being built downtown, midtown, in almost every neighborhood in this city. If you just drive around and see the old apartment buildings that have been vacant, see the work that's being done on them. But I think the rebuilding of the riverfront was a huge attraction. Certainly all the jobs that have come back have been a big attraction. Don't underestimate the Pistons coming downtown and bringing all the concerts with them, so that now the entertainment is really concentrated in the city of Detroit. But really, it is young people coming back in big numbers for the jobs of the future and the kind of environment they want to live in.
Right. Several years ago, I had dinner with Nikki Haley, and she just finished as governor of South Carolina. And I asked her what the favorite part of her job was as governor of South Carolina. And she said, I just love going to ribbon cuttings and when businesses are opening up and bringing jobs to my state, which she had a tremendous record of accomplishment. What's your favorite part of the job? I mean, you must enjoy a ribbon cutting, like when Gardner White opens up in Detroit and they're bringing jobs and opportunities for people. That must be a great part of being mayor.
There's no doubt, of course, the single greatest night in my time as mayor was the reopening of the train station. Bill Ford did there, and right next door, the abandoned public school book depository is now New Lab with 140 startups. But you're right, we've had 180 small businesses start with our Motor City Match program with grants, and I would say three quarters of those I've been at the ribbon cutting. Last week I was at a ribbon cutting of a Yemeni coffee shop at the corner of Michigan and Trumbull, absolutely beautiful, in the middle of a new apartment hotel district. In every one of these is a day of celebration, and now you got 10, 15 more jobs in the neighborhood. And it is fun to see plywood come off these vacant storefronts and see vibrant businesses inside.
You know, you mentioned the train station. I read that a really neat, cool hotel is going to be moving into there too, I believe. Isn't that the case?
Yeah, the Nomad Hotel. So this is Bill Ford is so remarkable. I mean, he's got well over 1,000 employees there. He wanted it to be a creative center for Ford Motor Company. But when he went up to the upper floors, the view up there is spectacular because there's nothing around it. You can see 360 degrees. And he said, I can't use this space for office buildings. And so this ought to be a high-end hotel. And so he took the top three floors. And interestingly, David, the top three floors have never been occupied. When the train station was built in the early 1900s, they'd gotten about halfway up when the Depression hit. So when that hotel, the Nomad, opens up, it'll be the first time in 100 years the top floors of the train station have been occupied.
That's outstanding. Well, so you have this great record of accomplishment. You were named by Governing Magazine the most effective mayor in America. As a recovering politician myself, you have the highest approval ratings of any political figure I've ever read about, 6-1. I was hoping for 50-50, and I never quite got there. So you decided not to stay on as mayor, and you're running for governor as an independent, which I have to tell you, when I read that, I thought it was a stroke of genius, Mike. I thought he's figured it out because most voters are independents and they want things to get done. They don't care about partisan politics. What led you to that decision?
You're absolutely right. And I didn't appreciate how it was going to resonate, but I am being stopped everywhere by people saying, I'm not 100% Democrat. I'm not 100% Republican. I'm always being forced to choose, and the two sides make the other out to be evil all the time. You're a politician whose views are where I am, and the crowds are reflecting that. But I was up in Lexington, an hour north of Port Huron, a couple of weeks ago on a Tuesday night. 1,000 people in the town and 100 showed up to see me, and it was a fun night. We're going back and forth. I'm answering questions. I'm talking about their town. And about an hour in, I say, how many of you would have shown up tonight if I were running as a Democratic candidate for governor? And about a third of the hands in the room went up, and they looked at each other, and they all started laughing. And they realized, even though these were their friends and neighbors, when it came to politics, they were normally so polarized, they would have never been in the same room. And if you just seen the feeling going out of here, saying we can talk about our problems and our issues without having to have a tense relationship with our neighbors, I think there's a real desire for that, and the momentum just keeps building.
Manko Duarte, an 18-year-old Detroit high school student, was deported last week, just three classes short of graduating, after being pulled over on his way to a school field trip.
Hannah Dellinger, the reporter with Chalkbeat, discusses the background of this story with Chris Lloyd and Jamie on JR Morning.
Well, the story of Manko Bargoya Duarte, an undocumented immigrant who dreamed of finishing high school in Detroit before returning to Columbia, well, it's taken a turn. His request for a stay of deportation was recently denied, likely ending that dream. It's a case that raises powerful questions about immigration policy, education access, and the lives of young people caught in the middle. And joining us now to break down the latest developments is Hannah Dellinger, who's a reporter for Chalkbeat Detroit, who's been following Mako's story closely. Hannah, good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, I just want to start with the human side of this story. I mean, talk about who Mako Boyoga Duarte is and what kind of made him stand out to his teachers and classmates in the community.
Sure. So the teachers and Michael Sears, who I've spoken to, said that he was a really hardworking student, a really good student. He would work night shifts as a doorman at a local hotel late at night and then still show up to school in the morning ready to learn. And he was really focused on getting his diploma. And he was only 3.5 credits away from graduating.
Kind of walk us through what happened the day of the traffic stop that led to his, you know, arrest and his detention. What role did the language barriers and lack of school oversight play in that moment? I understand there was some kind of language barrier that kind of ignited things. Tell us what happened.
Right. So Michael, who was a junior at Western International High School in Southwest, he was arrested on May 20th. He was trying to join a school field trip that was about 25 miles away from Detroit, and he was pulled over for an alleged traffic violation. He didn't have a driver's license, only a City of Detroit ID. And according to Michael's attorney, the local police at the traffic stop couldn't communicate with Michael because he was speaking Spanish. And they called Customs and Border Protection agents to translate, according to them, which Michael's attorney said that this raises all kinds of concerns and could be considered discriminatory to call Border Protection agents because someone is speaking Spanish. And so a final deportation order had already been issued for Michael last year, and he was in the process of working to get the documents he needed to get on a plane to go back to Colombia with his mom. And while they waited for those documents, Michael was attending school and trying to get his diploma. But he was detained by ICE at that traffic stop, and he's been in ICE custody ever since then.
How old is he?
He's 18.
18. Okay, so an adult in the eyes of law enforcement. What about his family, his mom? Anyone around him also detained?
Not as far as I know. They have not been.
What's the circumstances surrounding him coming into the United States?
I know that he came into the U.S. when he was 16, and we don't know, like, the circumstances of why they came here or how they got to the U.S.
They were planning on going back to Colombia after he graduated?
Yeah, they were waiting to get the documents that they needed. In order to get on a plane leaving the United States, you need some kind of documentation to show that you have citizenship to go to the country that you're going to, or permission. And that takes a while to get those documents. So they were complying with immigration orders and working on doing that.
Has the school board said anything, Hannah, about Mako's situation?
Yeah. So at Tuesday's board meeting, dozens of community members came out and they spoke for 2.5 hours calling on the district to release a statement asking for Michael's release so he can go back to school. And the board, after hearing all that, they did release a statement saying that. And some of the community members who showed up to the meeting were angry that Superintendent Nikolai Vitti had previously told Chalkbeat that Michael was not under the supervision or protection of the district when he was arrested because he was allegedly skipping school to try to join this field trip because he didn't turn in the permission slip he needed in time to go.
Okay, so that's against the rules. Driving without a license,
yeah.
Also illegal. But the idea when this all began was getting the illegal criminals, the people, the worst of the worst, out of the country. Is Michael, in the minds of those listening, someone that you need out of this country, is the question.
Michael, talking to the people who knew him, said that he never got in trouble, even at school or outside of school. He just went to school, went to work, and went home, and that's what he was focused on doing. And the people who are supporting Michael are saying, you know, he made a mistake in trying to join this field trip, but he's a kid, and this shows his age, and he was just trying to join the rest of his friends and be able to participate in what they were doing that day.
So where does this case stand now? Where is he being held? What's the situation legally here?
So right now, a stay of deportation was denied for Michael on Wednesday. So he's currently being held in Louisiana, and his deportation is imminent, according to his attorney. There had been some false reports that Michael was already deported yesterday, but as of this morning, he's still in Louisiana, and he's at the facility where the charter flights for ICE leave out of the country. So his attorney says that it's imminent that he's going to be removed.
So there's really no path forward for him to finish school here.
That's how it seems, yeah.
And from your reporting, I mean, what message do you think this situation is sending, not just to the immigrant families, but also to students about, you know, safety and belonging and how schools advocate for their kids?
Right. The students I talked to are really angry about this, and some of them come from families with mixed immigration status. So their families were already afraid to go to school and participate and show up because they're afraid of being detained. And this is kind of raised those fears along with all the other immigration policies that are and actions that are happening right now. And this is the only case we know of a student being detained and facing deportation in Michigan right now. But this issue is impacting so many kids in Michigan whose families are being deported, and we don't hear about their stories yet, but that's something that we're looking into.
All right, Hannah Dellinger, reporter for Chalk Beat Detroit. We appreciate you coming on this morning, giving us an update on the story.
Thank you so much.